It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Joff Parrish, co-editor at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
How are you feeling?
I already know how you're feeling.
Words cannot describe. No, my sweetie has come down with something, and I think I'm getting it. So if I, start blowing my nose all over the microphone, we'll just hope that the reggae folks don't want to use the microphone on this side of the tower for a few weeks.
They generally stay on my side of the board, so that should be okay.
No, that's good, because the side over here will be surrounded by, plastic tape.
Yes. All right.
Well, starting out with local, had a big election this last Tuesday.
Yeah, mixed results. Probably the best result of the batch was in the most important races, which were the state Supreme Court races, where it was very much feared, especially in the Jerry Alexander John Groen race, that the money the BIAW was pouring into negative attack ads on the sitting Chief Justice of the Washington State Supreme Court, Jerry Alexander, would result in a radical property rights lawyer getting onto the Supreme Court, the same way that BIAW has gotten two other lawyers onto the Supreme Court. And if they had won all three races, they would have had a majority on the Supreme Court. Well, they lost all three, which was very good news. Also good news, particularly for Democrats in the 8th District, although it was strictly symbolic, is that in their respective primaries, Darcy Berner got more votes than Dave Reichert in the 8th Congressional District on the east side. Now, that doesn't mean as much as you think it might, because the primary turnout is much less than the turnout in the general election will be. And it was close enough that those numbers could shift. Actually, they could shift either way. But it certainly will help Berner in her fundraising between now and November. And even though she's already out fundraised Reichert in the last three quarters, the GOP has also pledged to put a bunch of money into that race between now and November. So that's good news. There were several pieces of bad news, however. One was in the Maria Cantwell race, where she got 91% of the vote, and the mighty wave of anti-Cantwell protesters of the war in Iraq managed 4% in support of Hong Tran, which didn't exactly make a convincing case that the opposition to the war in Iraq and Washington State is a mighty electoral force. I-88, the money for the school levy in Seattle, went down to defeat. I'll talk more about that in a little bit. Also, we had the 43rd legislative race, the six-way race, where basically the three progressive candidates, Stephanie Pure, Lynn Dodson, and Dick Kelly, finished 4-5-6. Jamie Peterson, who's from a progressive standpoint probably the worst of the batch, still clings to a narrow lead over Jim Street. And the frustrating part of that race is that the three progressive candidates who finished 4-5-6 basically divided votes that combined would have won the vote pretty easily. In fact, you combine Pure, who finished fourth, with either Dodson or Kelly, who finished 5-6, at least with there's still a few votes left to count, and they're close totals, so that could shift, but as of now, and it would have been enough to win the race. Certainly all three combined would have. So they split the vote, and in splitting the vote, even in the most liberal legislative district in the state, there simply aren't enough progressive votes to go around for that kind of competition. And in a head-to-head race where it's just two candidates, that reminds us once again, as we've seen with Hong Tran and Maria Cantwell, that you can't just rely on progressives or Greens for an electoral majority, even in the city of Seattle, let alone statewide. You have to make alliances with other constituencies, and that's not something electoral progressives have been very good at. So some lessons learned. Certainly there were lessons learned by the city council and the mayor, because they watched I-88 go down to defeat, and they learned that the option for the tunnel replacement plan for the Alaska Way Viaduct was going to cost $4.6 billion rather than $3.6 billion, and that is only going to go up over time. And they made an about-face, both the Nichols and the city council did, and decided that they weren't even going to have an advisory vote on the November ballot after all, that they were just going to go ahead and vote and not have any kind of public input at all, which they have proceeded to do, and voted 7-1 this week to refer the matter to Christine Gregoire, and possibly the state legislature will weigh in on it with a new session, but Gregoire has said she's going to have a decision on which option to pursue for both the Alaska Way Viaduct and replacement of the 520 bridge by the end of the year. So that'll be before the legislative session is in place. And then if the legislature is involved, it'll probably be over allocation of money and how they're going to pay for it. But the reason for the about-face, you know, looking at the defeat of I-88, part of that was because of the mismanagement of the school district, and it doesn't portend well for the slate of progressive candidates that was elected 3 years ago that will be up for re-election next year, Sally Seriano and Britta Butler-Wall and Darlene Flynn and Irene Stewart. They're going to face a significant backlash, I think, over how the school district has gone in the last 4 years, even though they inherited a tremendous mess. At the same time, there's also the issue of Seattle residents are facing their limit on taxes. You've also got on the ballot in November not one but two different transportation plans, Nichols' very expensive and potentially indefinite tax to try and fix roads and potholes in Seattle, which is a good thing and its merits. Ron Simms' plan to vastly expand King County bus service, which is a good thing on its merits. But, you know, people can only afford so much, and particularly with property values having gone through the roof the way they have in the Seattle area over the past 10 years, you're already, you know, basically losing the middle class in Seattle. And those of us who don't make $100,000 who will still live within the city limits can really only afford so much. And it applies to renters as well, because those taxes, of course, are passed along in the rental rates. So the council and Nichols were looking at this, and what they realized is if they put the tunnel option on the vote on the ballot in November, it was going to go down in flames. And so they did exactly what the United States does in its foreign policy and decided that democracy is all fine and well as long as the vote can comfortably be predicted to go the way you want it to. If it's not going to go the way you want it to, you denounce the process or cancel it entirely. Just, you know, ask the poor people in Gaza Strip. And so it goes to Olympia instead. So for people who don't think that the tunnel option is the best way, you know, focus your efforts on Olympia at this point, because you ain't going to get a chance to vote on it.
I'd heard the vote was actually 6-2 with Della and Licata were the two that were opposed.
Well, there were two separate votes. Oh, one okay. was whether to use the tunnel option or not, and one was to put it on a ballot or not. The tunnel option was a 7-1 vote.
Okay.
And then for the other, it was 7-1 because Della actually wasn't in the room for that vote.
All right, moving along to national. The Financial Times came out with an interesting report.
Yeah, and one, interestingly enough, this is on Wednesday, and yet on Thursday and Friday, as near as I could tell, nobody in the U.S. media, certainly not in you know, the big East Coast papers, and goodness knows not in the Seattle papers, picked it up. The Bush administration, according to the Financial Times, the reason that Bush made his big to-do in the week before 9/11's anniversary of transferring prisoners to Guantanamo from the CIA secret prisons wasn't so much as an election ploy, although it did somewhat have that effect. It was because, according to the Financial Times, and I'm reading this as a direct quote, it's secret prisons. The Bush administration had to empty its secret prisons and transfer terror suspects to the military-run detention center at Guantanamo this month, in part because CIA interrogators had refused to carry out further interrogations and run the secret facilities. That's according to former CIA officials and people close to the administration. In other words, taking out a newspaper speak, what that means is that the CIA was afraid they'd be prosecuted for war crimes. Why is this relevant? Well, because also this week, Senators McCain and Warner and Lindsey Graham reached a deal with the White House, you know, Republican on Republican, and it was the 94-page draft of it. The deal was announced Thursday. Finally, yesterday, the actual draft was released, and it's got some horrifying details in it. This is not at all the, you know, the nuanced compromise that I think some people were hoping for. before, and that some press accounts have characterized it as. It's got a lot of worrisome aspects. It does ban some types of torture, but it leaves other types of torture intact. And of course, you know, any new types that happen to get invented or come along in the pike seem to be okay, because the president is given the authority to define Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions as it will apply to the United States legal code, which is exactly what he was planning to do already. He was planning to say it didn't really matter. We already know that habeas corpus was going to be banned. It was already banned under the Senate legislation. That stands under the compromise, quote-unquote. Hearsay evidence and evidence gained under torture are going to be allowed. There will be legal processes in place for top terror suspects like, you know, Sheikh Khalid Mohammed, but not for the hundreds of people in Guantanamo, including the many of them that are probably innocent that have continued to languish there. They will basically, because of the suspension of habeas corpus, be there for the rest of their lives unless somebody in federal government takes mercy on them. And an interesting loophole that hasn't been widely reported anywhere, a provision of this agreement sets back rape law by about 30 or 40 years by very narrowly defining how rape can be counted as either torture or a war crime. And it uses, you know, pretty specific language to very narrowly define what rape means. And, you know, unfortunately, the FCC doesn't really allow us to discuss pending FCC legislation on the air. But let us simply say that one of the more worrisome aspects of it is that it's defined narrowly enough that it only covers non-consensual sex. It doesn't cover sex, for example, with a prison or a detention facility guard who threatens the individual and, you know, the victim then needs to cooperate or, you know, face other consequences. That doesn't seem to count. And that's in, you know, direct contravenience to how rape has been defined in most states over the last 30 or 40 years. So, a lot of critics are concerned that this is being done specifically because those types of incidences, not just of sexual harassment, but of rape, both of women and of men and children, have occurred at Abu Ghraib in Iraq. And the way the language is being drafted is to exonerate U.S. soldiers and their commanders from responsibility for those crimes. It's a very, very worrisome document.
All right. Moving along, the wiretapping appears to be...
Yeah, that's the other thing to watch in the Senate right now before they adjourn for the year, is that the House and Senate Republicans are trying to ram through a bill that would retroactively make the NSA surveillance program legal. And the House version, unfortunately, was amended this past week in a way that is not good. In the past, the way the House version, which is was defined, was to make surveillance of any and all Americans legal if the U.S. had been attacked. Recently, that is, not just on 9/11. Now it's if the threat of an attack is imminent, which of course, you know, define imminent, define threat of attack, who's doing the defining, what information is it based on, et cetera, is an orange alert enough to, you know, wiretap every American? And at what point does that wiretapping then stop? So, again, very, very problematic legislation. You know, urge Cantwell and Murray not just to oppose this legislation, but the Democrats should have enough votes in the Senate on both this and the McCain-Warner-Graham compromise that if they want to filibuster it, they can, and they should.
All right. Alberto Gonzalez, Attorney General.
Yeah, testifying before a House committee, or rather a Senate panel on Tuesday, urging the panel to... that Congress should require internet service providers to preserve customer records to make them available for government prosecutors. The prosecutors, according to Gonzalez, need them to fight child pornography. And according to Gonzalez, without any particular documentation of this, child pornography is such, you know, I believe the growing threat is the phrase that he used. It's such a growing threat that it justifies the extreme invasion of Americans' privacy. Now, there's no particular evidence that it's a growing threat. I find child pornography and pornography in general as offensive as the next person, but the issue isn't people viewing the stuff. The issue is the treatment of the kids that are being victimized to make it, much of which is happening offshore. So that's the nature of the internet. But even if it isn't, if it's happening in warehouses or London or the San Fernando Valley or wherever, even that problem is nothing compared to the billions of dollars being spent by the movie companies and the pop culture icons and so forth to sexualize kids. Think of JonBenet Ramsey, as a 6-year-old going to beauty pageants and, tell me which is the greater danger to the American cultural fabric, and yet it's this that's being used as a bogeyman. And you were mentioning when we were off air also that it's a very popular sort of, scare story to air on these TV magazine shows it's something that strikes at the emotional fear chords in parents. But, compared to what the actual problem is, who's more responsible here, the billion-dollar corporations or the fly-by-night pornographers or even the not-so-fly-by-night pornographers? It just seems to me that doesn't excuse such a sweeping invasion of privacy for every American, because it's treating each of us as a potential suspect when none of us are actually being accused of a crime.
All right. Well, we got we just finished an election. Got another one on the way, and voter fraud is an issue that's going to be being talked about a lot.
Yeah, Rolling Stone, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. seems to be on a roll. He has a new article that was out this week. I believe it's available online, detailing the very real and present threat that the 2006 elections are going to be hacked. Toward this end, there was a pretty well-publicized demonstration by a bunch of Princeton geeks showing how easily the various voting machines can be hacked. And an interesting piece of trivia that came out of that, which was that according to one of them, the access panel door on a Diebold AccuVote TS machine, voting machine, can be opened with a hotel minibar key. It's essentially a key that's used for a lot of different types of office furniture, and it's commonly available on the internet. So, when you hear these assurances that these are absolutely tamper-proof machines, you just gotta cry or laugh or something.
It's a tool that many incumbents, of course, are familiar with, so that
yes,
helps.
And probably have on their key rings.
Moving along, there was some good news this week coming out of California.
Yes, a federal judge in a couple pieces of good news. One, a federal judge in San Francisco overturned the Bush administration's roadless rules that would have opened up about a third of national forest land, the roadless areas, to logging and mining operations. Those rules now revert to the Clinton administration's much stricter guidelines. Also in California, the state of California and the attorney general there sued the 6 largest automobile manufacturers in the U.S. for the cost to the state of California of global warming. This is the first major civil litigation suit having to do with global warming, and it's a real interesting approach. It's definitely going to be a case well worth watching, because it's true that governments and consumers and taxpayers are going to have to spend enormous amounts of money coping with global warming. And, obviously automobiles aren't the only cause, but they're certainly a significant cause. Of course, California has also been benefiting for the last 50 years by its extensive building of freeways, which was done at taxpayer expense also. So, it's a tad hypocritical, but at the same time, it's an interesting approach to try and, for example, force automakers and Congress finally to adopt stricter fuel records. In fact, I was listening to a record from 1979 that had an audio clip of various commercials as part of their sound mix, and one of them is talking, was using a clip from and it's a song that's critical of consumerism, is talking about, your highway mileage is up to 54 miles to the gallon, and you don't even hear that anymore. This was nearly 30 years ago, and we had better fuel efficiency standards then than we do now, and it's, very, very sad, and we wonder why we have hot summers every year.
All right, and finally, nationally, the Education Department has come out.
Yeah, there was an internal report in the Education Department that just came out, I believe, yesterday. In fact, it's one of these classic D.C. stories of bad news being buried on a Friday, saying that the Bush administration has been violating the law in its implementation of the Don't Drive Left Behind Act, specifically that the Education Department has been forcing states, even states who don't want to use them, to use certain curricula approved through No Child Left Behind, and that curricula, of course, is being made and distributed by companies with close Republican ties. So, imagine that. Bush administration helping cronies out, knock me over with a feather. But, there are serious concerns of illegalities there, so something to keep an eye on.
All right. Jumping over to the international, United Nations this week, there was plenty of speeches and sparring.
Yeah, and I highly recommend both the Hugo Chavez and the Evo Morales speeches at the UN General Assembly this week. Morales didn't get nearly as much attention, but he's sat at the podium at the General Assembly and waved around a coca leaf, which, for starters, sort of makes a mockery of the, U.S. border enforcement laws and the whole war on drugs, and basically said, and I'm, he said it more poetically, that this is a first world problem. It's not our problem. We've lived with this for thousands of years. Clean up your own act. And then Chavez got on the floor, and of course his comment of George Bush being El Diablo got a lot of attention, but you should really look at the whole quote, if not the whole speech, because right when he's talking about him being the devil, and he had a hilarious line right after that saying this place stinks of sulfur, and it was because Bush had been there yesterday. And Chavez goes on to say something like, this guy stands before you on this podium like he runs the world, and he doesn't. And that whole part of the speech really hasn't gotten very much attention, but it's, right on the money. You're getting this demonization of Chavez in the media, but he's saying stuff that people in this country need to hear, because it's what most of the global South is thinking about the United States at this point. It's not just Chavez.
Well, and one of the other people that was in town, not here in New York, was General Musharraf.
Mm-hmm.
And he was...
the dictator of Pakistan, who tried to call himself president, and Bush seems to use the term, but nobody else seems to. Musharraf came out with the allegation, I guess, on one of the Sunday morning chat shows last weekend, that Richard Armitage, speaking on behalf of the Bush administration, had told him in the wake of 9/11 to cooperate with the new war on terror, or we will bomb you back to the Stone Age. And Musharraf, of course... said he found these remarks kind of rude and offensive. Who wouldn't if your country was being threatened like that? And, of course, it puts Musharraf in a very difficult position, because the primary threats to his power come from the very large Islamist constituency within his own country, for whom cooperating with Bush is tantamount to treason. At the same time, Bush himself was asked about these allegations, and the following day he said essentially that he knew nothing about it at all. We'll just kind of let that comment lie there.
All right. Moving on. Palestine-Israel.
Yeah, several things there this week, and some of it's kind of insider baseball. Hamas and Fatah, the two parties that had agreed on a unity government, that's fallen apart for reasons too complicated to go into in the short amount of time we have. Hamas had made a couple of different truce offers to Israel. One, to have a truce for 10 years that Israel has refused. Another one that's now on the table, that the Palestinians would be willing to settle for the 1967 borders of Israel and Palestine in exchange for a truce. But that's almost a moot point, because the separation wall has superseded those 67 borders in some very real and no pun intended concrete ways. At the same time, three of the Hamas ministers who were kidnapped / arrested / detained by Israeli security forces this summer are now alleging that they were tortured by Israel while they were in custody. So yet more gasoline on the flames.
All right. And Iraq.
A lot going on in Iraq, quite a bit of it at the General Assembly, actually. Kofi Annan, before the opening of the General Assembly, saying that he believed that Iraq is in danger of sliding into full-scale civil war. Again, something the Bush administration doesn't want to hear. By the way, there were 2,000 anti-war protesters gathered outside the UN building on the opening day of the General Assembly, just in case you didn't see it on the evening news. The UN Special Investigation on Torture, or investigator on torture, issued a report this week that was real interesting and extremely critical of the U.S., and this needs to be publicized more at a time when, obviously, the Senate and the White House are negotiating how to define torture. So let me read a couple things from the report very quickly. One, detainees' bodies, that is, prisoners in Iraq, show signs of beating, use electric cables, wounds in different parts of their bodies, including on the head and genitals, broken bones of legs and hands, electric and cigarette burns. Bodies in Baghdad's morgue, quote, often bear signs of severe torture, including acid-induced injuries and burns caused by chemical substances, missing skin, broken bones, back, hands, and legs, missing eyes, and wounds caused by power drills and nails. And, of course, if they survive all that, they simply get shot in the head. The report is basically also included a quote from a U.S. Army major saying that Baghdad is now a Hobbesian world where everyone is at war with everyone else and the only protection is self-protection. The reason I bring all this up is because a couple of years ago we started hearing reports filtering out of D.C. of people in the CIA and the Pentagon discussing the Salvador option, that is, a way to combat the insurgency by mounting or sponsoring via proxy death squads, the way it was done by the U.S. In El Salvador in the 1980s. 2 years later, particularly since these death squads have been operating out of the Interior Ministry of the Iraqi government, that has been put in power by the United States and continues to be trained and funded by the United States, it looks like that has very much come true. And those are the connected dots you're not hearing on reports. And oh, by the way, 5 days this week, 200 more death squad victims were found in Baghdad alone.
All right. And quickly, local events.
A couple worth noting this week. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, the 25th to 27th, from 4 to 6 p.m., there will be a vigil at the Federal Building for the Declaration of Peace, part of a national campaign that a bunch of peace groups are putting on, where you sign up saying that you want peace. And also on Thursday, the 28th, at Town Hall, 7:30, Seymour Hersh, the fabulous New Yorker reporter who's done many, many important stories on the war on terror, will be in town. It's a part of the Foolproof series. I'm sure that's sold out, but I'll bet there'll be people scalping tickets, or maybe you can get somebody to sign one of them or something.
All right. Talking with Jav Parrish, co-editor of Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
The anniversary issue is out. It's at places where you find free periodicals, bookstores, cafes, places like that, King County Library System. It's also on the web, and hopefully that big fat issue is actually on the web by now. Should be going up any day. At www.eatthestate.org. And if you have comments, questions, tips, want to volunteer, want to send donations, any of that kind of stuff, give us a call. Our voicemail, area code 206-719-6947.